Now, as a lobbyist, what sort of methods do you use? You contacting the Congress people, sending them like media packages, that sort of thing, and press releases? What's the methodology sort of thing you do there?
Everything and anything that'll work.
try to get the attention of the power brokers, type of thing.
You're trying to get the attention of the people who make policy or influence policy. But XPAC, for instance, for years has sends out what I call congressional alerts. And these are one-page faxes. You don't email stuff. They don't read email. One-page faxes that go to every member of the House and Senate regarding some aspect of the issue.
Yeah.
And those are archived at the XPAC website, x-ppac.org. And there have been scores of press releases that have been put out by XPAC and Paradigm Research Group. Those go out to the media, and in some cases the Congress, depending upon the context of the press release. And my media list is up to around 5,000.
Oh, wow.
Now, with the internet, it's possible now to get to an even larger media base, and I'll be using that in the future. This is important development. PR Web is an example of a site that, for a modest amount of money, your press release gets dispersed to huge numbers. So, and the internet is an emerging and powerful force for change. And it's certainly going to help advocacy, and already is starting to do that, though it's only just beginning. But you get press releases out on these issues. I have talked to people on the Hill, not enough of that. I've talked to a lot of reporters, engaged a lot of reporters, and tried, constantly to get the issue into the news, into the arena, particularly the arena of talk. Show news, talk show interviews, and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I have not been a success. I've personally done a couple of Fox News, but there have been other shows that have been done. I think I've helped to influence that. But some of the real breakthroughs, which didn't happen, just couldn't do it. Tried to get Ted Koppel into this issue for 6, 7, 8 years. He didn't do it, wouldn't do it, finally retired. But there has been an attempt to engage the executive branch one particular time during the Clinton administration. So that is, and these are things that can be done without much money, and so that's where I've focused most of my activity. I've started speaking more, and so that gets you at another audience, and you build up mail lists, have mail lists, and you get things out that way. And so raising the public awareness is certainly part of advocacy, the educational part of it.
Yeah.
Certainly done what I could do there, but there's so much more that can be done. I mean, believe me, I could name 20 projects that could be done with if the money was there to do them. So we're still nibbling at this thing. But that's what I do now. Now you can talk about what is a true lobbyist do, and you can examine the life of a standard K Street lobbyist in Washington D.C. And they have, and they're paid $80,000 or $100,000 a year, sometimes millions. And they have, they develop important connections and insider connections, and they get in touch with these people, and then they arrange to get a meeting with a member of the House, and they'll sit down and they'll pitch them on what's going on with that organization, and they have like an influence circle there, and there's quid pro quos and favors that are passed around and that kind of stuff, and these firms operate in that way, and there are books about that. But I'm really in a different arena because I'm not getting paid $100,000 a year, and I don't have a lobbying firm behind me that's got heavy-duty connections, and many of these people that come in these firms are former members of the Congress. Some are former high-level officials, so they got these contacts. Don't have any of that, right? Because remember, I'm in the ghetto.
Yeah,
I'm in the intellectual ghetto that was created. So I have to operate in other ways. Call it guerrilla advocacy, if you want.
Yeah.
And viral advocacy, this kind of stuff. But should we be doing that? Yeah. I mean, if the money was there, look, if I had $2 or $3 million, I'd probably hire a lobbyist. I might actually hire a firm, right, to do or work with on this issue and get access that way. Or any number, certainly hire a PR person. I'd hire a full-time PR person, or at least a full-time consultant that would be, I know the people I could get. And that has a very significant. Public relations is part of advocacy. Public relations is, are people that know people that can get people at certain places to hear and see and do things and whatever, and that's part of advocacy too. And but they cost money. The good ones cost good money. So if I had mine, I'd definitely get one of those. Again, the number one thing that the government was successful in doing that made it possible, though it seems almost incredible that they succeeded, so that 59 years after the crash at Roswell, which got out into the public there for a while, and they had to work pretty hard to keep it under, keep it contained. And everything else has happened. 59 years later, in spite of the fact that half the American people poll, and important polls like CNN and Time polls and Reuters and others, that they believe that ETs are in fact behind the UFO phenomenon. That the government's lying about it. In spite of all that, 59 years later, the government has not been forced to acknowledge the presence of extraterrestrials. It's really amazing. How is it possible? Well, the number one thing that they did that made that possible is creating that intellectual ghetto I told you about to a degree that no money was available. Keep the money out. If you can keep the foundations and the universities and private wealthy Americans from funding this issue, then we can play this game.
Yeah.
As long as possible. And they did. And the amount of money put into it has been minuscule over a period of nearly 60 years, in spite of the fact the issue is probably the most important issue in the world. That was quite a feat that they pulled off. But you gotta also say that the foundations and the wealthy Americans that went along with it have a certain responsibility here. They bought the baloney. They ate it.
Yeah.
They digested it and they pooped it. They completely went along with this. Now, whether they knew or in the know, and it was they went along with it because they felt it was a national security matter and it was in the best interest to keep this embargo going, or whether they were just entranced and gullible, whatever, they went along with it. Because now it's also true, and I will, to be fair, that in the early days, certainly as you go back toward the beginning, I think, of the era, which is 47, I think it's possible some people were intimidated intensively. I mean, extensively intimidated. They were threatened big time, and I think some people were killed.
Yeah.
So later, as things evolve, just a few hints about that is enough to get a lot of people who are wealthy and have a lot going for them and don't need to die prematurely.
Yeah.
Would rather just enjoy their wealth and their good life would stand down. And how much of that has gone on, I don't know. In other words, it's the old German approach, right? You go into the town, you haul 20 people out, you kill 5, and then you ask the other 15 to go along with whatever the hell you want, and they sure as hell do.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think to some degree there was a certain amount of that. You know, part of the dark history of America, which is plenty of darkness. Plenty of darkness there. This ain't the shining city on the hill yet. We have a ways to go before we get there.
All right. Now, reflecting on your congressional run in 2002, it's been about 4 or 5 years since then. So, looking back on it, what do you think of it now? Looking back on it, and were there surprises, and were you sort of marginalized as a candidate, not only because you were an independent, but also because of the UFO issue?
No, I was marginalized, absolutely marginalized, and it's been almost amazing enough. It's been almost 4 years. Well, we started the campaign in April of 2002. First of all, any non-two-party candidate, any non-Democrat or Republican candidate is marginalized immediately.
Yeah.
This is another problem we have in the country. We have allowed the two parties to become too dominant. We have tried to create an intellectual ghetto for third-party candidates, literally.
Yeah.
If you're not a Democrat or Republican, you're a kook. You gotta be. You know, I don't care. Were you a World War veteran? Do you have a PhD? Have you got a Nobel Prize? Whatever. You're a kook. You're a third-party candidate. You're not a Democrat. You're not a Republican. You're nothing. You can't win. And the fact that you're running and can't win shows that you're kind of a, Don Quixote. All third-party candidates are just Don Quixote's tilting the windmills. And so we marginalize them. We won't let them in the debates. And the effect is to
limit their ability to bring ideas, even if they can't win, bring ideas into the arena that, that might be helpful to the country. So we get the same crap from the same parties year after year after year. And because it's the same stuff, and because it really doesn't have vitality to it, and it's so hard to embrace it, each year the elections get more and more expensive because it's like, and then there was their attitude. They got a product they want to sell to the American people, and nobody wants to buy it. So instead of simply making the product better, they spend 10 times more money advertising it. So the idea is, like, I've got a crappy product here, but I'm, instead of spending $1 million promoting it to you, I'm going to spend $20 million this time around, and you're going to, and it's going to be so heavily promoted to you that you're going to have to buy it this time. And so the elections get more and more expensive, but the outcome of the elections become less and less important in some ways, though not always. And so I call it the politics of money for nothing.
Yeah.
And it used to be the politics of money, but then it became the politics of money for nothing, which is even worse. So I got a good picture of that when I ran. So I had there were two things going on in that campaign of 2002 in the 8th District of Maryland. One, I got to experience what it's like to be an independent candidate in a real election. And that's important because if you're on the ballot, you have the potential to affect the other two candidates. In other words, and my goal was to get 5%. My dream was to get 5%. I barely got, I got less than 1%, so I didn't make it. But if I had gotten 5%, if I could have gotten to that level in that campaign, I had the potential to actually influence the outcome. Now, that will get their attention.
Exactly.
And then one of the reasons that they diminish all third-party candidates and shut them out is to some degree, whether they like their ideas or not, is that they don't want them to be able to influence the outcome. So whether you're Democrat or Republican, you don't want a situation where they have the swing votes. So you want them to be as minimized as possible. So they're there, but they don't get enough votes to matter. But nevertheless, they never can be sure. And occasionally an independent candidate will get to that point where they can influence. That's a real problem for them. So I experienced what it's like to be an independent candidate, right? And a lot of the 20 or so debates, I was kept out of 16 of them, and a lot of that was just because I was an independent candidate. It didn't matter what my issue was.
Yeah.
Right. And that was interesting, and I got a good glimpse of what that was like. And then I got, the parallel experience of what's like to have the ET issue be your major issue. Interestingly enough, that wasn't a big deal. I did not get much grief about that.
Oh, really?
I think it made it a little easier for the Washington Post to ignore me, which they did, and the Washington Times, to my surprise, made it a little easier, but they weren't going to go out of their way as an independent candidate anyway.
Yeah.
I think the ET issue, occasionally a third-party candidate will have an intriguing issue that will capture the attention of human interest. In my case, I had an incredibly intriguing issue, but the paper stayed away from it. I think that was because of the ET factor, because the Post is pretty much a partner with the government on this issue. I mean, the Post has gone along with the government on the ET issue from the very beginning, as long as it's existed. And they need to be asked about that.
Yeah.
Someone needs to really get in the phone. Why did you do that, Bob, Ben, Kay, right, Sally? Why'd you do that? I'm sure their answer would be, I have no idea what you're talking about. But I experienced that, and it was great. It was great to know what it's like firsthand. And I'm able to speak to that when asked. Would I do it again? No. The only way I'm going to run ever again for Congress will be if I can win. And the only way that's ever going to happen if disclosure takes place. And my work gets elevated to a national level. And people say, well, look, why don't you run? And it would be a party candidate and take the issue into the Congress and be representative of that issue. So one of the things that people forget is that the members of Congress are not just there to, you know, represent their every whim and need, meaning, you're my representative from my congressional district, and I want you there, and, you know, every clean thing that I need, you're going to take care of it. Well, I mean, that's, to some degree, that is true. I mean, it is true, but they're also there to represent the country. Every single person votes for the country, right?
Yeah.
when these bills come across, that they don't say, well, it doesn't affect my district, I'm just going to abstain. You vote for the country. They address issues of peace and war, and pass legislation that has potential to have incredible impact globally. So they also need people there that can speak to these issues. Then they can hire somebody on their staff to handle the constituency issues. They do very well, but they focus on these larger issues. Nothing wrong with that. We don't have enough of that. We need more people in Congress that can stand up there and talk about the big issues and not, you know, immediately be voted out of office because, oh my God, you talked about a big issue. You're only supposed to care about when my trash gets picked up. So that's a narrowing of America's perspective and the voter's perspective, which is, again, a mistake. So the answer to your question is, I got treated badly as an independent. I was given actually a certain kind of a pass, I think, or a little bit of leeway as the ET guy. And I was never dissed on by the candidates, the other two candidates, and I was in debate with them, and I was in panels with them, and they never in any way diminished me. Of course, they would have viewed me as a non-entity. In other words, don't even focus. I don't even mention the guy because, I mean, all I do is give him some prominence. But
yeah,
they didn't attempt in any way to make fun of that issue, which was notable.
Did they engage in the UFO issue when they were in sort of debate structures with you? No.
They got asked a couple. There was a couple situations where, because of the nature of the debate, whatever question was asked of one candidate was asked of another. And so I was asked a question regarding the focus of the campaign, and then it got asked of the other people. And they simply dodged the question. In other words, they gave very neutral, vanilla responses. But it's notable that they in no way said, oh, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right.
And what about the voters now? When you spoke to some of the voters, what was the general consensus from them? Were they happy to hear somebody finally saying something about this?
Those that knew about the issue were very supportive and thrilled that I was doing that, and they would be very excited at times about it. Those that understood the issue, those that were willing to even speak up about it, were very supportive. And I got a lot of supportive emails and letters, and I appreciated that. I wanted to do so much more, but again, money.
Yeah.
I think I had, I spent a total of maybe $11,000 on the campaign. That's all I had. Mostly my money, but some donated money. Nevertheless, I developed some skills of getting the issue out, but unfortunately, and this is just a fluke, at the very point in the campaign in 2002, when the most media would have been focused on that election. And it wasn't a national, I mean, it was a very nationally followed election, this particular election involving Morella and Chris Van Hollen, was very well followed, more than most, which is one of the reasons I did it. At the point in which the most focus would have been on the campaign and thus could have drawn my issue into play, something bizarre happened. We had two guys show up, a guy named Mohammed and a guy named Malvo, who, a man and a boy, came into the district and started shooting people.
Oh.
From the Beltway snipers.
Okay, yeah.
And they were shooting people in my district.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. At the store, I mean, they were shooting people at grocery stores where we've been campaigning. And it was the biggest story in my memory in the Washington area. And it was absolutely consuming. It consumed all of the press attention for weeks.
Yeah.
And so the campaign almost became incidental. It was like, who cares? And that was just unfortunate because a lot of work went into trying to get to that point where there'd be some focus on that congressional campaign and I might be able to get some awareness factor. But instead, it was all about two guys killing people from the back of a car, which I must admit has a certain metaphorical power to it. It sort of symbolized the state of the world, namely that every time there's an opportunity to focus the world's attention, the people's attention on important issues that could improve their lot, somebody blows something up, somebody starts a war, somebody kills somebody. This happens all the time. So as
it was a microcosm of that. And I have a certain appreciation for that. I mean, we operate in the real world. We suffer the real world's vagaries, and I'm no exception.
Okay, now, and moving on to sort of the last of your of stuff that I want to talk about from your background here is the X Conference. Obviously, like I said, that was a major turning point for my evolution as a researcher and activist and writer and all that. What are you obviously, this was your brainchild. How did it come about, you know, and what, reflecting on it now, what do you think about it, the logistics involved? Was it surprising to you? What surprised you? What didn't? And, you know, as an auteur, you know, as the creator of the X Conference, what did you think of it?
It was essentially a success. The idea was to create a conference which is really reflective of the era, the new era, which is I call the era of exopolitics, and not the UFO era. Conference that was de-emphasized phenomenology. There'd be some there, but really it's backseat to documents and government stuff and government posture and cover up and embargo and witnesses and that kind of thing. Modeled in a way, well, the X theme is the X Files, of course. That was intentional because there's still a lot of interest in the X Files. So the Exopolitics Expo was called that so I could then nickname it the X Conference. I mean, it was a different approach and it was well responded to. We had, given that Washington has not had much experience with substantial conferences of this type, even UFO conferences. And it's a conservative area. I mean, conservative, not necessarily politically, but conservative in people's choices about what they do with their time. It's not the Bay Area of San Francisco, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C. So we had a good turnout, though. We had about, get the numbers right, 550 paid and 650, I think, total, or 650 paid and 750, I can't remember. So we had a strong turnout. We had the presentations were fine. People loved it. People were very moved by the conference. And I was very pleased at that. But, again, getting back to the ghetto thing, because there was no money, I had to essentially bootstrap the conference with nothing but a credit card. I compensated for lack of money through labor. I mean, I put 1,000 hours, maybe more, maybe 1,300, 1,400 hours into this conference.
Oh, yeah.
I was paid nothing for that, and then the conference lost $20,000.
Oh, man.
First time around, it just didn't get enough. We needed another 150 people to break even, which would have been a lot to ask. So I took responsibility for that, but the point is that it almost destroyed me. I was wiped out, plus physically, and then financially wiped out. This is ghetto stuff, right? In other words, you literally have to make bricks without straw.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. But nevertheless, I made another attempt at it for the next year, and starting with even less money. And was able to pull up second conference. Not as many attended. It was down around, I think it was like 450, 350, 450, 350 paid, 450. Still plenty of energy, well-received, and about half the speakers were brand new, or new to the conference, and
yeah,
so it went well. And it was sad, but they lost $20,000, too, in spite of the fact that it had been redesigned. So the effect of that was to literally flatten me financially, and so I had been recovering from that for some time, and I'm still very much in need of funding. So now the third X conference is hanging in suspension. It's going to take a minimum of $55,000 to conduct the third conference because there are certain things that have to be cleaned up from the first two.
Yeah.
And I will not attempt to bootstrap the third one. It's simply too much, and I can't physically get to it. So the next conference, a perfect example, and this has all been repeated before. I mean, believe me, I'm not unique here. I mean, throughout the 60-year history of this, nearly 60, people have tried everything they could, whether it's getting a book published or having a conference or anything else, and they have to do it with less. They have to do it. They have to be creative. what have you. And they always pay a price. And that's the result of operating within the electoral ghetto that the government created. And I ran up against it there. But nevertheless, I'm glad that it was done, and I want to keep it going. I hope that I get lucky here and I get a major backer that will come in for a minimum 55 so that the conference can be run. And I think the third time around it may be financially successful so that it will create what amounts to a self-sustaining franchise for this conference. It will be held in Washington. I don't want to hold it anywhere else. It needs to be held in Washington. This is where the power center is. This is where policy is made. This is where this information needs to be injected. It's like an injection of a vaccine or something. Someone has to be injected in a certain part of your body, otherwise they don't work. So this is where the information needs to be injected in Washington, D.C., not L.A., not San Francisco. So the game plan is to do that. And the conference is with film, and almost all the presentations are available through Lost Arts Media at lostartsmedia.com.
Yep.
People can buy those presentations on tape. They can also buy sets and what have you. And that's important. More and more we're able to do that. And there are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lectures now that are on DVDs and tapes.
Yeah.
So to an extent, the history of this era and a lot of the people involved are documented, recorded. On the huge numbers of tapes. This is, again, in many cases, particularly mine, and the people that are filming are not being paid. They're doing it simply as a service and maybe make a few dollars selling them later. So, again, it's very much a citizen grassroots thing. It has been since 47, but it's no longer enough. This is grassroots. That's all fine and dandy, but the civil rights movement, every major movement still's got to get big time in order to affect change at a national level, big stuff. You simply can't. Grassroots. The grassroots is good to a point, then you've got to get bigger and more elaborate organizations and funding in to complete the process of social change. This has yet happened, not yet happened in this field, which is why today, if you were to contact the United States government and ask them, what is your position on extraterrestrial phenomena? They would say, we no longer investigate such phenomena, and we do not believe that there's any threat to the United States, which is remarkable. But still, their position has been for decades. What's remarkable about this is that their formal position, when asked, never denies the presence of extraterrestrials. It only states that they don't investigate it anymore, which is not true. And it doesn't pose a threat to the United States, which we hope is not true.
Yeah.
And the reason they don't deny it, because they're asked this all the time. I mean, they get queries coming in over the last 30, 40 years. Thousands of queries have come in. So imagine if they were to respond to all these queries by letter or whatever, saying that there's absolutely no, there's nothing here. There's no phenomena. There's no ETs. And every one of those things, I mean, they're going to have to eat it.
Yeah.
Right? Have to eat every one of those denials. So they don't, which is smart. Right? They dodge it. But that process of dodging should be the tip-off to every single thinking person in the country, including every journalist in it, still has a few brain cells left. But there's something going on here. Because if it wasn't true, the government would deny it flatly. But they can't. They don't get it.
All right. Now, we're sitting here, it's Martin Luther King Day, actually, on January 16th, so it's sort of the beginning of 2006. Let's talk a little bit about the past year in exopolitics. Now, I have three particular events that I thought were important. I'm going to work backwards chronologically from them, and obviously the first one is the big Paul Hellyer story coming out of Canada. Now, I'm not sure how involved you were with that, but I know you were speaking at the same conference as him in Toronto in September. So why don't you enlighten us to your thoughts on the Paul Hellyer story and what any insight you can give us into that?
Well, as it happens, this comes under the heading of things happen if you do stuff. If you don't do anything, things don't happen. But if you do stuff, things will happen, sometimes things you didn't expect. Mike Bird, a Canadian, approached me back, well,
was after it was after the 2005 X conference.
Might have been before. I think it was after. About coming to Canada to speak on exopolitics in Toronto. And I said, great, let's do it. Set it up. Get a venue. And the hope was we could make some money, that we could get some funding.
Yeah.
Well and good. So there, that's how it began. But Mike, who's very committed to this issue and wants very much for disclosure to take place, embargoed end, started to think more expansively, and he felt, we're going to do this. Let's get some other speakers involved. And so he started looking into that. He drew in some additional help from Victor Vigiani, who's also a person up there that's interested in this issue, he knows. Victor had other contacts. And so they eventually were able to get, Paula Harris was going to come over, but she had to cancel. She got ill. Stan Freeman, who is, of course, a Canadian researcher for many, many years, was invited in. And Richard Dolan, who is very important in his field, as Cornevac, our designated historian. He wrote the book, UFOs in the National Security State. He's right down in Rochester, really close to Toronto, so he was invited up.
Yep.
Myself. So they had a more elaborate event, and they got a nice venue at the University of Toronto. They have a convocation hall there, which is well-known and kind of cool venue. Nice venue. And off they go to develop this. It's called Exopolitics Toronto. Because this thing was in play, however, Victor Vigiani noted that Paul Hellyer, who was a well-known political figure in Canada, a very vibrant, active 82-year-old, who so had been in politics there forever, who had actually been the former defense minister in the 60s under Pearson and the deputy prime minister under Trudeau, had formed, I think, two independent parties, and I'd been a member of parliament, and then whatever. I mean, he just did it all.
Yeah.
That he was a supporter of Alfred Weber's initiatives with ISIS, the Institute for Cooperation in Space, which is focused on preventing the weaponization of space. And it's, but it's also another Weber's, the founder of Exopolitics, so he has kind of a dual life there.
Yeah.
That Hellyer had endorsed. I think he produced an endorsement for his book, Exopolitics. So there had been some contact between Weber and Hellyer. So he was sort of engaged, somewhat engaged. So Vigiani approached him and said, would you like to speak at this conference, this symposium? And he demurred at first, then made the decision, I think very deliberately, to in fact present. He had been getting himself up to speed on the issues and reading some books and what have you, and so, lo and behold, it comes to pass that Paul Hellyer presented for 30 minutes at the Exopolitics Symposium, and because that was announced, and they put out quite a few press releases, it really attracted the press up there. The press in Canada is less constrained than the press down here, either because they're not in the trance or because they've not been, their organizations at the publishing level, the ownership level, have not been co-opted by the government. Which is to say the United States government's reach does not extend to Canadian press at this time. So they had no problems interviewing Hellyer, and he was getting called to interviews, and there were articles and papers all over Canada, which is nice to know that there's a country nearby where that takes place in case you finally get fed up with what's happening down here. So that attracted a lot of attention. And I was up there. I gave the keynote. I right after he spoke, I followed him. We spoke later at the press conference, and I've got his contact information. I've been in touch with him. And what's more important is that he didn't back down. He continued to take interviews. And he was on MSNBC.
Yep.
He was interviewed by Tucker Carlson, of all people.
Yeah.
He did a Fox News International, and we'll do more, I think. During all this, he was getting married, oddly enough, interesting enough, in 82, getting married.
Okay.
And then the elections were called in Canada. The government was dissolved. So he has been preoccupied with some other things, but I think it's clear that he's committed. He's going to follow this through.
Yeah.
And so Hellyer is now a player, and with any luck, we'll get him down here to speak of some things and perhaps get him more involved with the press down here. And that's one of my jobs. That's one of my principal projects for this year is Hellyer, development of the Hellyer's engagement of the issue and getting it into play. The other thing is that around all of this is developing now what I would consider a relatively substantive disclosure process now in Canada. We wanted a disclosure process to develop in Canada for some time, and I talked about it. Other organizations have talked about that. And there have been some attempts to sort of get it going, and it kind of bubbled around, but now I think it's really underway. So there's early disclosure movement in Canada, and it's coming from multiple directions. It's coming from Alfred Weber's ISIS, Institute of Cooperation in Space, and his other project, Peace in Space.
Yeah.
He's approached in conjunction with the disclosure project out of Virginia, here's Stephen Greer's operation,
yep.
The Canadian Senate, to hold hearings. He's approached the government on the concept of a decade of contact. He's also approaching the UN. Others are doing things to engage the Canadian government, including during this time of election, which will be soon, I think about 7 days. And I don't know to what extent the issue has been raised in the elections. I encourage them to do it. I encourage, for instance, Hellyer to hold a press conference. Don't know if that's happened. I'm out in the West Coast right now. I'm a little removed from this. I'm not in a position to simply go to Canada and cause trouble. So I don't know, but it's been mentioned once or twice. It would be nice if it could get really in there. It would be very significant if it became a part of this congressional, nothing but Canadian election. However, the parliamentary process up there is much different than ours, as most people know. They call an election and they hold it a couple of months. They don't spend $1 billion promoting every candidate. And they actually have this power change without throwing unbelievable amounts of money down the drain. The parliamentary system appeals to me greatly. If we were to switch to it in this country, I wouldn't complain. But whatever, it happens over very, very quickly. So it's hard. There's not enough time without a lot of advanced preparation. This is fairly much of a sudden thing to get into a parliamentary election process like that. So it may not, but still, it's important. So that is the situation regarding Canada and Hellyer.
Now, also then, working backwards then from the Hellyer story, was the Brazilian Air Force release of UFO documents. I'd say that was probably a pretty big exopolitical event of the year.
It wasn't just a release of documents. Essentially, A.J. Gavard, who is the leading Brazilian researcher and also the publisher of Brazilian UFO magazine, has been working to try to engage the government for some time. And apparently, there's some sort of a breakthrough. And so with absolute certainty, the Minister of Defense of Brazil, and this is another now Minister of Defense that has taken a step, current as opposed to former, with the sign off the Minister of Defense, the Air Force sort of got in bed with the UFO research organizations there, of which Gavard was a principal member. And there was an agreement to get together. There was an agreement they would release some documents, though that's still in process, and there was discussions about joint investigations. What's important here is that the Brazilian Air Force, by doing this, is giving their imprimatur to the citizen research, something that overall the U.S. government never done.
Yeah.
They've destroyed some civilian research organizations, but they have a tag, given their imprimatur. And that is non-trivial. And one of the most important things that anybody needs to know about that has to do with something I love to mention. For some reason, I'm just going to kick out. Gun camera footage. Again, the obvious sometimes is right in front of your face, you don't know it. For 50 years, craft have been flying all over this planet, in the sky all over the planet. And nations have been sending up planes to intercept or investigate. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody also knows that going back to the war, I mean, planes are fitted with cameras. Not all, but many. Combat planes are fitted with cameras so they can record what happens in combat. That's where we got all those films of Zeros being shot down and attacks on Japanese ships and so forth.
Yeah.
In the modern era, though, the cameras became even more important in that as we evolved into these, well, as the Cold War certainly evolved, into two camps, where you had nations on one camp, nations on the other camp. You have all these countries with air forces and military planes, and everybody's a little twitchy, and so anything turns up in anybody's skies, they send planes up to investigate it, and they always film it. They gotta have cameras in those planes so they can record what they saw. And if an event takes place, something gets shot down, they have evidence as to what happened to avoid national incidents, international incidents.
Yeah.
So these cameras are incredibly important. And so you've got all these craft, and you've got planes being launched to intercept them. Did anybody not think that they're filming that? Did anybody not understand that the gun cameras that they put in these planes are filming these intercepts so that when they get up there and they see these craft and the craft maneuver away from them, what have you, they have that footage. Every country in the world that has an air force, reasonably sophisticated, which is virtually every first world country and most of the second world countries, including Brazil, including Mexico,
yeah,
they have this footage. And they keep it. And it's notable in the United States that while there's been some success in getting documents from this agency and that agency through FIA requests from time to time, nobody can get the gun camera footage.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
They ain't going to get released. You can file all the FOI requests you want till hell freezes over. You're not getting that gun camera footage. Because the gun camera footage from the planes of these nations in and of itself completely confirms what, of course, we know to be true. Which raises the question, why do these countries sit on this stuff? And that's an interesting question. And it has something to do with the fact the United States has got more nuclear weapons than anybody else, got more money than anybody else, won the Cold War, won World War II, and everybody sort of feels indebted to us, something like that. So Brazil's got that footage. So does that mean the elements of the Brazilian government know there's ET? Of course. So when the Brazilian Air Force puts that imprimatur out there, that's a message that's being sent back to the United States that we're getting a little impatient with this embargo that you've been maintaining for now 59 years.
Yeah.
And I never miss an opportunity to remind our government of that. And in fact, I'm about to send out new reminders of that within the next couple of weeks, both in press release and in congressional alerts.
Awesome.
Reminding them again that there's nations out there that are, right, losing patience. And it's very possible that 1,000 years from now, some kid will open up their history book in class, and they'll be discussing this incredible era in human history, and they'll be talking about how Brazil was the first nation to announce to the world that, in fact, there's extraterrestrial engaging, and they showed footage of some of these craft maneuvering in front of their cameras. And God knows what else they may bring out. And the United States would be a backseat participant to all this, drought kicking and screaming into the new paradigm, moaning and whining and crying. And that will be the history 1,000 years from now. Or they can get with it and take leadership position here. So you're getting a glimpse again of advocacy, another little component of advocacy.
Now, this one kind of came up, actually. It's not in the list of three, but what you're talking about here with the Brazilian thing sort of jogged my memory. What about this India Daily thing that's going on online where there's constantly UFO stories coming out of India Daily? I don't know if you're too aware of
it. Oh, I'm aware of it.
Okay. Well, what do you think's going on with that? Because it's very intriguing.
It is. It is intriguing. Well, first of all, a couple of points. One,
India's got 1 billion people. Actually, it's got more than 1 billion people. So, it's a pretty important country. Isn't that the country where all the cows just wander around in the street and poop on the sidewalk because they're worshipped or something? Well, that's true. I mean, they have their problems, but they got 1 billion people. And they're smart. They're very smart people. And which is why they're doing all our software for us now. And we're shipping jobs over like crazy. They have a military. They have an air force. They have gun camera footage. They have some advanced technology programs, and they have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So India, I'm sure, fully intends to be part of the post-paradigm world and not just some overpopulated backwoods country, you know, second to Phil. But it does have its hands full. With a billion some plus people, they have enormous infrastructure and domestic needs. It's still a poor country per capita. But nevertheless, all this other stuff's going on, and you know that India's paying attention. So, not too long ago, all of a sudden, this online entity called India Daily starts putting out all these stories related to ET phenomena, cosmos, and other tangential stuff. And there's two things you can say about it. It's almost tabloid, but not quite.
Yeah.
Some of these things have a tabloid quality to them. The kind of short story that you might, and it's all internet. I'm not aware that India Daily even has a paper version, but it may. I don't know. In fact, I need to look into this.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been trying to find out information about it, but I'm coming up blanks.
But these internet stories, which are universally fairly short, not long, are kind of about the length that you might read in an Enquirer or Globe or something, which occasionally we'll write. Now, even you get down below the level of Enquirer and a Globe, and you get to the World News Daily and stuff, it's all made up. It's all silly, but it's fun. I mean, I think the people that work for World News Daily and these other total, what I call the absolute low-end tabloids, have the most fun of anybody. So it's not that level. It's more the level of a story that might turn up in the Globe. However, not quite. There is a level of sophistication to most of these stories, which is above the level of a tabloid.
Yeah.
And occasionally some of them seem too far out there, but not many. And most of them are out there, but not that far. And it raises the question, what's going on? I think that if, and I'll know more, I think, in time, I do believe that India is behind it. I think that the government of India is behind this. I think that this is their way of getting in play, of marking some territory here, letting the world know without ruffling any feathers. Meaning this, the Indian government, if it wanted to, could put out government releases about what it thinks about all this. But if it did, it would, of course, be ruffling the feathers of the United States.
Yeah.
And you know the situation in the Middle East and in that area. It's a mess.
Oh, yeah.
You get your Pakistan-India problem, they're nuked, and then you get your Pakistan-Afghanistan issue, and of course you've got Iraq. So, and India's got a lot of other problems, and it desperately needs lots of money from us. So for the government to start putting out very provocative releases of any kind, indicating India knows anything about anything, we could create political problems short-term for them. So what I think they've done is authorized that's interesting information, provocative. Possibly some dissell info in there, but also some stuff that points to things that they are working on or know about, is being released in a kind of quasi tabloid fashion through an internet entity like the India Daily, in a way of letting us know, the U.S. know that, you know, we're not totally, out of the game here, and we're not completely willing to be utterly silent about this. It's like a little message. That's kind of the way I see it right now. I enjoy them. They're kind of cool, and I hope they keep doing them. And at some point, I have them all. I'm going to collect them, and I'm going to review them all kind of in a group. But, again, I think it points to a very possible development there within India, which is not surprising. I mean, they're 1/6 of the world's people.
Yeah.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. Big thanks to Steve Bassett for appearing on the show. He'll be back next week. We're going to talk about the ABC UFO Peter Jennings special that aired last February. We're going to talk about what some of the big 2006 exopolitics stories may be, and we're going to talk about, in depth, the roadblocks to disclosure, the various scenarios that many people paint as to why disclosure cannot or will not happen. Steve tackles them head on, one by one, and gives us his perspective on why disclosure is possible and will happen. And all that is next week on Banal of America Audio, February 18th, 2006. Be there or be square. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron and R. Lee of banalofamerica.com. They produce the columns at banalofamerica.com. If you haven't checked them out yet, you're missing out. They're producing some top-notch stuff. I hope you check that out. Those are at banalofamerica.com, weekly columns. Also, my weekly columns, Banal Report. I track esoteric radio like it's my job. Feature articles, satire. You will laugh. I'm telling you, you will laugh when you see these pictures in the hot news section. Check those out at banalofamerica.com. If you're a frequent banalofamerica.com visitor, click the PayPal button. Throw some money in the bucket. Someone did last week. Big thanks to you, sir. You know who you are. Thank you very much. Now that the first guy has gotten out of the way, what do you say? You want to be the second, the third, the fourth? Start throwing some money in the bucket. Click the PayPal button. It would make my day. Help keep Banal of America Audio and banalofamerica.com up and running. We would really appreciate it. And now that I got the plug out of the way for banalofamerica.com, I want to thank all you great listeners out there for checking out the show, for downloading the show, sending me the emails, posting it on the message boards and the blogs. Totally appreciate it. I'm so happy to hear from many of the listeners who are sending me emails saying, oh, I love this interview, I love it with this guy, or the one from a couple weeks ago was really good, or I just found the interviews and I really liked one from, you know, back in September or something. I'm getting a lot of those emails, so people are slowly but surely discovering the esoteric insanity that is Banal of America Audio. Big thanks to all you great listeners out there. If you haven't checked out the archive, we've got tons of episodes now. Enough to keep you busy through the weekend. If you're snowed in or working out at the gym, download them, put them on your iPod, bring them to wherever you're going to go, long road trip, whatever. There's tons for you to dive into there at banalofamerica.com. Thank you for listening. Thanks for checking us out. Come on back next week so we can wrap up the conversation with Steve Bassett. 2006, big exopolitical stories, what might be on the horizon. We take a tour around the globe, various countries, what they may do in regards to disclosure, and of course the roadblocks to disclosure. What are they? How does Steve Bassett see us getting around those to make disclosure happen? That's next week. February 18th, 2006. You'll be hearing from me then. Until then, this is Tim Banal, signing off.